Moncrief on News Talk.
You may have sometimes thought to yourself you'd like to go on an adventure holiday somewhere remote and definitely not for tourists. But to travel to such places can come with an element of risk, something Rachel Gatto knows all too well. When she and her partner Malcolm visited a country you may not even have heard of. Rachel, good afternoon.
Hello.
Have you done this kind of thing before?
Not as risky as this one, but I have taken a lot of sort of wild trips, you know, like to Far East in Bhutan to live with a remote tribe, backpacking in southern China. And, you know, I'm no stranger to heading off, that's for sure.
Right. OK, to kind of off the beaten path
yeah.
kind of places. How do you even arrange trips like that? I assume there isn't a, you know, a travel agent who'll do it, set it up for you.
Sometimes it's just putting a pin in the map and doing some research and seeing, is this interesting? This particular trip that we went on, we were actually going to go to Colombia and then realised it was too touristy for us.
Yes. It is, yeah. Yeah.
It is quite, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it was literally just moving along the map. And then Suriname, and we just said, what about Suriname? Did some research. And then we usually go onto YouTube and then find the deepest story behind a country and then see, is it something we're, you know, wanting to go for or not.
Yeah. And tell us a little about Suriname. It's a tiny place, which is why I said a lot of people mightn't have heard of it.
It's true. And well, it's just on the top of South America. So there's, they call it the Guyanas. There's British Guyana, French Guyana, and then Suriname, which got its independence, I think, in the 70s. It was a Dutch colony. And so it's a real melting pot of ethnicity, cultures, language. I think there's 9 spoken languages in the country. And they pride themselves actually in having a mosque and a church, Christian church, next door to each other. They see themselves as a sort of a really homogenized society.
Mm.
And the interesting thing for us was it is 95% primary jungle. So there's really only one town called Paramaribo, the capital on the coast, and there's only 3 roads in the country.
Huh.
Yeah. So they just go straight one way, straight another way, and one perpendicular. So connectivity is difficult.
Right. And even getting there.
How do you get there? You go straight from Amsterdam. Because it was a Dutch colony. Actually, I think there's only 2 flights a week, international flights a week out of the country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you went there, you had planned it in advance. And like part of the plan was traveling downriver.
We joined a sort of extreme travel company for a descent down a remote river called the Saramaca River. And so the plan was that we would get dropped with 2 guides, myself and my partner, nobody else. And it takes about 8 hours to even get to the departure point in a buggy up a riverbed, basically. So the plan was to spend 7 days descending down the river with the flow of the river. But it isn't as easy as that, because sometimes it still is rapid. There's all sorts of hazards. There's rocks. You have to climb out. You have to get your kayak back going. And we're carrying all of our kit, where we sleep in hammocks on the edge of the jungle, and we have these sort of waterproof drums that carry dry rice and lentils and some decaffeinated instant coffee, a bit of sugar. So basically we're completely self-contained, and the water we drink is through filters. So we just drop our bottle into the river, suck it through a filter. So we're carrying as little as possible.
Wow. And the river itself was a bit hairy at times, as I understand it.
It can be tricky.
Yeah.
When you have the rapids, sometimes if they were, you know, particularly difficult falls, we would beach ourselves somewhere and make sure our boats were safe. We'd climb down the rapid, look at it and decide how we were going to tackle it. At one descent, we actually lost the guide. And
oh, God.
It was not great seeing him.
You found him again, though, I hope.
It's because I saw his helmet come down the river. I'd gone down ahead and his helmet came down empty. And I was thinking, this is not good. And then eventually his kayak came down mangled upside down. And then he followed it about 10 minutes later. But, you know, it's tricky. It's not for the faint hearted, that's for sure.
Yeah. So by the time you'd traverse the river or navigated the river, I should say, then you were going to spend some time with the community there.
That's right. So we spent the week on the river. There's a lot of known hazards there. But the second half, we had decided that we would return to Paramaribo, the capital. And there's these little bush planes that fly deep into the jungle. And it's the only way most people connect, if not by river. And so we returned after our trip. We were fairly bedraggled. A quick turnaround of about 4 hours and into a bush plane with a couple of other people to fly an hour and a half into the depths of this jungle and landing in a remote airstrip. You wouldn't imagine that you'd even have a landing strip. And then suddenly out of the cloud, out of the blue, there's this little kind of brown looking strip and straight down, and you bump, 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 and you've landed in the middle of nowhere again, quite literally.
And who were the people there that you were going to spend
time
with?
They were an Amerindian tribe. So they were they're indigenous people with their own indigenous language. And their history is that they went further and further into the jungle when the plantation owners came, when there was all the growing of the sugar cane and slavery. So they disappeared as deep as they could into the jungle so they couldn't be found. And they're still living there, some of them. And there are uncontacted tribes in this area also.
Oh, my word. So you arrive there and no phone signal or anything like that out there,
no.
I assume. No way of contacting the outside world.
There's no way of contacting the outside world. The manager of the tribe, as he was called, they had radio contact with the tribe, with the city. So that was really all it was. And we learned a lot from them, you know, about the plants, the trees, how they eat, how they hunt. It's very interesting.
Mm. When did you start to feel sick?
It was on the afternoon of day three, looking back, I just didn't want to drink water anymore.
Mm.
And I said to Malcolm, I just taste disgusting. But by that evening, I had become quite unwell. I was unsure about what it was. I actually thought I had food poisoning or something. But within a couple of hours, I was in a pretty bad state.
Okay. And you had a temperature?
At that time, we didn't have any thermometers or anything, but I just knew that I was not well. And that says something for me, because I'm you know, a bit roughy-toughy. I'd broken my toe and nearly stepped on a poisonous snake, you know, a couple of days before that. So I was already dealing with a broken toe. So, you know, it has to be quite tough for me to recognize. So I was wondering.
Yeah. And so, but I suppose as luck would have it, that was the piece of luck you had. There was a doctor in your party.
There was a 25-year-old guy called Coon, and he'd just done a 6-month stint in the hospital in Paramaribo, and he was using his last few days, and he'd come on that bush plane, didn't know him at the time, but he would be instrumental, in fact, in my survival.
Yeah. And so when he examined you, what was his diagnosis?
He said it's either appendicitis or you have something acutely wrong with your gallbladder. Because I was testing positive for the physical tests, the differential. So I didn't see him until the next morning at dawn. I battled through the night myself. And I told Malcolm, I said, you sleep, because if I need help in the morning or an advocate in the morning, I need you to be okay. Yeah. I wanted him to be switched on.
Yeah.
And so it really was, I woke Malcolm at 5 and I said, I'm in serious trouble here. And we had to wait till dawn. There's no electricity or anything. So you'd be wandering around, stumbling around the jungle, looking for people, you know, with a head torch. So we waited until dawn. And then I said to him, go and find Coon.
Yeah. And at that stage, did you have even rudimentary painkillers or anything of like that?
Not at that point, no. I mean, I hadn't taken anything because I was unsure of what I had.
Yeah.
So when Coon actually arrived and he quickly examined me and he said, what have we got? And we pooled, literally all of us pooled what we had. And we ended up with a couple of paracetamol. A thermometer. He had his stethoscope, which is most doctors, I suppose, carry. And then later in the morning, they had a rummage in the village and they did have a medicine chest and there were 2 bottles of saline solution, a sterile line and a cannula that was sterile. Mm. So that was the sort of sum total of what we had. And Coon had a word with me, you know, and he said, look, this is serious. And I said, but it's not life-threatening. And he said, it is.
Oh, gosh. And so, yeah, that's great news to hear that.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah. But your temperature, because they did have a thermometer at that point, like how hot were you?
It had gone over 40. So I was really, at that point when they took my temperature, I was so unwell.
Yeah.
And in agony.
Yeah. Now, as you said, though, there was a radio. They could radio for help.
Mm-hmm.
But then it started raining.
It had started raining very early morning and, you know, we were in these little huts and the roof is corrugated iron. So you can hardly hear yourself. And when I say, you know how it rains, I come from Galway, you know how it rains in the West, right? This is times 10.
Yeah.
It is unbelievable rain. So the rain had come, but it kind of comes and goes. We had been in a sort of apparently the dry the short dry season, but it just didn't work like that. So it hadn't occurred to me that I would not get help. I just assumed that the plane would land and I would be taken somewhere. But that was the difficulty, that the message came back that it is way too wet for anyone to land today, let alone fly, because you've got these terrible thunderstorms. And when we were flying in, I was so intrigued because I was sitting right behind the pilot. So I was closer than you are now. And he's like this, you know, he's looking at one cloud, turning his head, looking at another cloud. Then he just banks around a cloud because it's dark. And we're just avoiding the thunderstorms as we weave our way through the clouds. So the thing is, you know, I just assumed that somebody would be able to take off and that I would be whisked away and found to a nice hospital somewhere.
Yeah. So that left you effectively stranded there with a temperature of 40 degrees. And so I assume you got a bit worse.
I was deteriorating literally by the minute at that point. And Coon was in and out trying to talk to the city with Malcolm and all of this. And he decided my heart rate was too high. And so what he did, he said, I'm going to use one of the bottles of saline solution. So they rigged up this jury rig and put a line in and hung it off my mosquito net. And he was hoping just to keep me with enough fluids that I would stay unstable enough. So my memory is of just being so desperately ill and being incredibly vulnerable because you're entirely reliant on everybody else. And I was watching Malcolm's face and I knew by the look on his face that this was something I didn't really want to ask about the outcome of, because at that point I learned later it had got very, very serious.
Yeah. So how long was it before help could be sent?
What happened was somebody in the airport had said we might get a chopper into her, but the rain again. But the whole thing was he took off, this very, very kind man. I actually found out later he was the owner of the local airline, bless him. Really lovely man. Wayne Gummels is his name. And so he did a kind of a two-stop hop to us and landed, I think, late in the afternoon. It was before dark anyway. And the size of the helicopter, it was smaller than a mini, you know, it was tiny.
Yeah.
And so I was carried on a door out to the helicopter and I was literally manhandled in and a bag was shoved beside me to keep me upright. Malcolm was shoved in the other side. There were no doors on this helicopter and I don't really like heights. So I was really unwell, but the heat, they rigged up the final bottle for the journey and Wayne, now you know his name, he turned around and looked at me from the pilot's seat and I saw his face and I thought, I'm definitely in real trouble here, because his face was unbelievable. And at that point, I just remember hearing music. Something happened. I must have fainted. I must have gone somewhere else because it was gorgeous. And then I was jolted back into this horror, the pain, the agony, everything. And then we took off and we sped over a jungle for an hour and a half at just above the treetops. And this guy just kept turning around and eyeballing me. And he flew and flew and flew and flew until we got there.
Yeah.
And we landed in the small little tiny airfield. And then we had to get a taxi.
That must be really now. Comfortable. Funny now, yeah.
But it wasn't at the time. A taxi to the to the hospital. So, you know, I was like, good God, you know, do we not get an... But apparently the ambulances don't do what ambulances do here.
Yeah.
So we took a cab and the cab driver must have known, because I remember him saying, like, stay there. And he came back with this wonky kind of trolley thing for me. And I was helped into that screaming at that point.
Oh, my God. And what were the conditions like? Was it fairly basic in the hospital when you went in?
Fairly basic. They had triage. And I was in a corridor with loads of very ill people. And I was very ill myself. So it was kind of just a recognition of, here we are. And I've been in, you know, life-threatening situations before. This is not my first experience of it. But that happened in a first world hospital, you know, in Ireland. So, you know, it was just a recognition of this is different. But I'm vulnerable. I need help. And I'm going to be with everybody else. But I was triaged. And She did my blood pressure, and then she kind of made some face and took it off my arm. She says, I'll try the other arm. And so she put it on the other arm, and then she turned the blood pressure monitor round to me and tapped it as if it was my fault kind of thing. And she said, you have no blood pressure. And I looked at it, and I remember thinking 50 over, you know, 40 something, you know, and I was computing, and I was going, yeah, oh God, that's not good.
Yeah,
that's really not good. And I was swiftly pulled backwards in that wonky trolley into a bay somewhere in the hospital. And what transpired after that was, you know, it was, I'm still a little traumatized by what happened, you know, after that. Yeah.
Yeah. What, in the surgery? Because I assume the surgery happened pretty soon after that.
It was a while. I think what was so traumatizing was we had a language difficulty. Mm. It was a very different healthcare system. And Malcolm was turfed out. So he was busy on his phone saying, I'm taking her to Columbia. There's an American hospital in Columbia. And this lady surgeon came in and dropped her glasses, and she eyeballed me directly. And she goes, do you want to be alive? And I said, yes, I do. And yes. And so I said to Malcolm, we're staying. And she said to Malcolm, she will not make anywhere else. If you don't leave her here, you know, she's not going to be around. Mm. So it was, you know, that had sunk in at that point. And then Malcolm was turfed out. So I was then abandoned, and they said, come back tomorrow evening. So I was moved from place to place to place. And the next thing I remember was being wheeled in the dark outside in the rain and delivered to this door with a neon sign outside and left. And then somebody came out of this neon sign door and pulled me in. And it was kind of, it wasn't like, hello, welcome to the operating theatre. I didn't know where I was.
Yeah.
And I was very sick. And they'd given me a load of morphine. So I was a bit
out of it,
as well.
Yeah.
So I was parked there for a while. And there was still somebody in the operating theatre. And I'm parked outside it. And, you know, so it's a bit sort of
my
raw
word.
And then this guy comes in to me and he says, we you go to sleep, you wake up. And I just remember saying, I hope.
Yeah.
You know?
Crikey. Now, obviously you're here to tell the story, so you did survive. It was your appendix when they examined you in the hospital.
It was actually, I had a gangrenous appendix, if I don't want to ick anyone out, and it had spread to my stomach. So I was in sort of in the septic area,
yeah,
and it had flooded my stomach. So I was in, you know, I was in a big bad way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you then woke up after the surgery, was there sheets for your bed, or, you know,
it was
those kind of things?
It was very confusing, Sean. Mm. I was in the pitch black. Now, I wasn't sure had they operated or not, because I was in a lot of pain still, but all I knew was a different pain, and I was in the pitch black, so I couldn't see where I was. I could sense the wind, right? So it took me a long time to work out. I kept falling asleep again, but it wasn't until the lights were slapped on at some time early morning and a troop of nurses came in, all with incredibly white uniforms, quite scary. And then I kind of figured out, okay, I'm in a ward. There were actually people around, you know, there were people near me. And the people in the ward were extremely sick as well, you know. And then I put my hand down and I realized, I've got a bandage here. So
something's happened.
Something has happened. I'm minus something.
Yes. And then, so what's it? It was towards the end of that day that Malcolm was allowed back to see you.
He snuck into the hospital, actually, about lunchtime. And he literally made a sort of deduction going through corridor after corridor and found me. And then somebody said, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm just bringing some pieces, because I had no clothes to change into. I was operated on in the same clothes I had. And I had a sheet, and that was it. So I actually, you know, was feeling incredibly exposed because they'd taken my clothes. I had flip-flops, but they were no longer there. So I had, you know, there was no soap or no towel or no toilet paper, that sort of thing in the hospital. Some of it was really modern, but other parts of it were really challenging.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
But
so.
But I'm grateful. I'm not complaining,
yeah,
guys.
No, absolutely.
You know, I am very grateful for everything I received there, because I wouldn't be alive without it.
Yeah. So how long did you stay there for? Did you have to stay there for, or choose to stay there for?
I chose to stay 2 nights.
Yeah.
And I discharged myself on day 3.
Yeah.
And then I moved to a hotel for a while.
Yes. Well, you know, after everything you've been through, no one could criticise that decision at all. You have a daughter.
I do.
Yeah. Who, when did she hear about all of this? Because obviously you were out of contact for such a long
time. This is a bit of a funny story. I hope nobody minds me telling it.
She might not think it's that funny.
No, it was actually, I said to Malcolm, I said, do not tell Nicola. Now, the backstory is my husband died when I was pregnant with Nicola. It's another story. But so we have a very good relationship. But we're very close. And anyway, I said to Malcolm, I said, please don't tell anybody anything until you know I'm going to live. That was my only line. So he rang her the next day and he didn't know, so he didn't tell her. And then when he did know, he rang her up and spoke about the weather for about 5 minutes. And then, by the way, by the way, so when I did speak to her, I got a barrage of I am going to kill him, because you don't ring up and talk about the weather and then go, by the way, your mum's been very ill and she's in hospital and had emergency surgery in Suriname. So it was very funny.
Oh gosh. And so then when you got back to Ireland, you got checked out and it turns out they did a reasonably good job in Suriname.
Turns out they did. We had a plan. I wasn't supposed to really fly. It was all kind of messy, but we jumped on a plane and we decided that we'd get as far as Amsterdam and if necessary we would pull off at Amsterdam. And when we got to Amsterdam, I said, I'm heading for Dublin.
Yeah.
So we got on our next flight and I was checked out and they had emailed me pictures of the surgery. I'm sure nobody wants to see those, but they said it was pretty in line with what they would have done here. And so I was very happy and I was put on more antibiotics just as a precaution. And, you know, I think it's about 6 weeks ago now, I'm back, you know, at the gym, I'm doing stuff and I'm planning, you know, I hope if I'm allowed.
Marbella, hope you're going to say.
Nicholas says Belmont.
Nice package holiday. gee, what a story, Rachel. Thanks a million for coming in to tell us about all that. It was Rachel Gatto there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.